Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for Father's Day. Welcome, Catherine. Welcome, Tim.
Hello. Happy Father's Day, you fathers.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, today we've got an exciting show. We have a voter forum, a candidate forum. We have Rashad Taylor and Joel Alvarado. Both are seeking the House 55. State House district that's being vacated by Abel Mabel Thomas, and Joel and Rashad are both very well versed, but we'll save all of the introduction for them to give us their own bio in just a few minutes, but that's what we're looking forward to. Been a big week, though. I don't know the date it exactly became official, and it may have been before last week's show, but this week it really set in that we truly are down to the Democratic candidate, the Republican candidate for the presidential election. Could y'all feel that this week, Catherine and Tim?
Oh, I definitely felt it this week. I think
Absolutely.
It's exciting. I think it looks good for the Democrats.
Yes, I think this is a position we knew we'd be in. We were, 82% of the people are not happy with the direction we're going. We start out with a tremendous lead right there. Tim?
Oh yeah, it really looks good, especially when you look at the generic numbers, not just the presidential election, but down ballot. I think we're really going to have a big year. The Republicans have a lot of seats to work on all over the country. They got a lot of open seats. They got a lot more seats to defend than we do. So even down to the local level, David, I think it's going to be a great year for us.
No, I just don't see where it can be with the dynamics. Also, people had talked about this for a while. They said once the nomination is decided, look for a rise among the Democratic nominee when you're just polling one candidate instead of two. And sure enough, Barack Obama, I think a lot of places had him up at least seven up from what he was before.
Yeah, he got a nice bounce in several polls. And that also translated into a nice electoral bounce. We can truthfully say if the election were held today, we'd elect a Democrat.
Oh, certainly. Did y'all happen to see Barack Obama's Father's Day message? I was just reading about it. I didn't get to hear it. But it was that he probably, maybe he was saving it for Father's Day, or maybe he was saving it till he became the Democratic nominee. But it's one of those kind of things I think will also give him a little boost. He talked about, black fatherhood, and it's a real crisis, and really it's a real crisis among all races in America today, but then in black community it's even bigger, where you have a lot of, bigger absentee fatherhood, which, he had in his own life. Luckily he had his grandfather to kind of pick up the slack, if you will. But he, talked about that today, and I thought that was a timely message. Tim, Catherine, are you picking up on that?
I didn't read it or see it. But I'm glad to hear him talking about it.
Yeah,
I'm glad he's talking about the issue of race head on, David. Do you know what I mean? He's taking this issue head on, and talking about it candidly, and I think it deals with this issue in a way that people are not going to be so concerned about it anymore.
Well, and this is not so much like looking at his race. He's looking at he lived it one way growing up, but now he's doing it as another way as an adult. He speaks from a perspective in which he can fully grasp it, and it's something that needs to be said. Bill Cosby took a lot of criticism, and it may be possible that Barack Obama would take criticism in some quarters for it, but probably not quarters that are swing voters, if you will, or even Republicans. I mean, maybe those hardcore Michael Dyson-type people that don't want anybody to ever be criticized. But it was just, I guess, you know, Bill Clinton had his sister soldier moment. Now, this is probably more important than that was. Interesting you brought it up at this point now that the nomination's decided.
If I could compare it to something else, this happened in a different way in 1960 when John Kennedy had to candidly address the issue of his religion to the Protestant ministers down there in Dallas, Texas. And he did it in such an eloquent way that he essentially took that issue off the table. And I believe that Senator Obama is doing the same thing with race relations.
Yes, I think so. And then, of course, John McCain's campaign, you just don't hear anything about it. It's just unbelievable how little you even hear what's going on there.
Yeah, he's really boring. He's boring, and he's boring, yeah. and he's kind of cranky, and he's just not very interesting. I'm sure that the media doesn't really like covering him. I mean, I don't know, but it seems like he's not very interesting to cover. You know, he's not nearly as dynamic as Barack Obama or even as Hillary Clinton was, and McCain's just boring. You know.
Well, and it's not so much him. I think that it's their party is just not excited about him, or I'm not even sure if they're excited about anybody. You know, there's probably a lot of Republicans that are kind of soul-searching. They're sitting there going, you know, George Bush, he you know, called the playbook just like we want it called, and it sure ain't working. And they're having to go, well, we don't like those Democratic answers, but the Republicans don't work. What are we to do? I mean, it may be some of that.
Well, you understand why McCain made that proposal for all these town hall meetings with Obama. He's trying to be relative. He's trying to get himself in the news, and he's trying to do it in a free way in a forum that would favor him. I think it was smart of him to suggest it, but I really hope that Senator Obama doesn't take the bait and do it.
Well, actually, he has decided to agree to some of those debates. And really, a law professor is usually pretty good on their feet. You know, I mean, while Hillary Clinton did better on the whole than Barack Obama in the debates, and that's kind of consensus, he didn't do poorly. It wasn't like, oh, my goodness, this guy's got major flaws. It's just
Hillary Clinton's
a little better.
It ain't about how poorly he performed in previous debates, David. The question is, why would he do this? What would he have to gain, just politically speaking, by agreeing to appear with Senator McCain? Who could it help except Senator McCain? He is behind. He knows he's behind. And that's why he proposed this.
Well, I guess it's kind of like Roy Barnes in 98. Guy Milner was behind, and he, said, hey, I've got a truck here, let's go debate. And Roy Barnes said, fine, I'll out debate you anywhere, anytime. I'm just a better debater. And that may be part of what he's thinking if he does agree. And he's agreed to some of these. I think we're ready. It's right about 7:10, the time we thought. And I have two new callers from the 404, which is most likely in the 55th House District. So welcome candidates, Joel and Rashad.
Hello.
Hey, David, thanks for having me.
Excellent. Both on there. Well, I think I'd already let you know about the ground rules. We're going to just ask y'all questions, the panelists, and y'all can answer. And then we might have a little closing statement towards the end. But we're going to try to be civil and let the voters know, where y'all stand and about y'all's background. But I know y'all are both class guys, so there should be no problems with that.
Okay, sounds excellent.
Yeah, well, what we'll do probably for the first round of questioning, we'll go alphabetically last name, and then the next round we'll just switch it up. So, Joel, we'll let you have the first answer on the first three questions, and then we'll come back. And let me think. We're going to do two and two, so we'll kind of switch it up so we have a little fairness. But the first question will come to you, Joel. Joel, just tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, first off, David, I want to thank you for allowing me to have an opportunity to speak to the voters tonight. And I want to wish all the fathers out there Happy Father's Day. Being a father myself of a 3-year-old son, I know men usually get the short end of the stick when it comes to holidays. So, you know, I hope every man has taken this day for all it's worth and enjoying it, because come Monday, they'll forget about you again. So happy Father's Day. And regarding me, I'm just a regular guy. I born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, had the opportunity to attend Morehouse College in 1991, graduated in 1995. From that time, I served as a congressional aide, as a county-appointed official in DeKalb County, as a civil rights lobbyist, and worked in a policy think tank, and now I own my own political communications company called Power of the Pen. I've served on numerous boards and commissions and nonprofits from the state, local, and, of course, the nonprofit level, active in my community, and I'm just trying to find an opportunity how I can address the myriad of issues that are impacting people who live in this district and the state. You know, I just want to serve at the best of my ability, and that's why I'm looking for a chance to hopefully get into office on July 15th, so that way the people in District 55 can have somebody who has the professionalism, the experience, and the leadership, and the conviction in order to serve with integrity.
Yes, well, thank you, Joel. Rashad, tell us about your background.
You know, Dave, I'm originally from Washington, D.C., and came to Atlanta. Also went to Morehouse College and had a chance to work for John Lewis in Washington, D.C., and Max Cleland back here in Georgia, and worked at the Capitol for a few years. I worked for Senator Vincent Fort when Democrats were in control, and he was chairman of the Retirement Committee. And I had the opportunity to be a lobbyist for Planned Parenthood. And now my full-time job, I'm actually political director for the Democratic Party of Georgia. throughout my time here in Georgia, I've had the opportunity to serve in many capacities as well on the board of NARAL Pro-Choice Georgia. I was one of the founding members for the Atlanta Jobs with Justice group here, trying to bring a living wage to Georgia. I've served on the board of the Youth Task Force, which is a human rights and civil rights youth-led organization. And I've also, in my sort of spare time, led living wage campaigns. I traveled across the country on behalf of Wellstone Group, Paul Wellstone's nonprofit organization, to numerous college campuses, training young people on how to organize and how to run living wage campaigns. And just want to continue that type of work that I've been doing in the community and at the Capitol as a legislator.
Yes, well, it sounds like for neither of y'all qualifications are a problem. So let's go on to what your motivation is for running. Rashad, tell us why you got into this race.
You know, I've worked at the Capitol for a number of years for a number of good legislators, and I've seen a lot of good things happen. But I felt for a long time, you know, a lot of people have different callings. Some people's calling is to feed the hungry. Some people, you know, is to teach. And I've always thought that my calling in terms of community service is really through electoral politics. When I was a political consultant, I only took clients that I really believed in, that I thought would do a good job if they got elected. I've organized, you know, voter registration drives, trying to get more people involved in the process. I've worked at the Capitol trying to pass good legislation and stop bad legislation. So I've always thought that my sort of service to the community would be, you know, through electoral politics. And I just, you know, want to continue that work. We watched as this Republican legislature got nothing done for the people of Georgia. There was no movement on transportation, solving the congestion problems that we have here in Atlanta and around the state. There was no movement on trauma care funding. So hospitals like Grady and Savannah Memorial really, you know, got nothing from this legislature. There was nothing done in terms of tax relief for the people of Georgia. Nothing done on gas prices. There's nothing done but a lot of fighting and bickering. And so I want to go down there as a fresh, you know, voice, new energy, sort of new ideas, to try to work with people to get things done.
Yes. Joel, tell us about what motivated you to run.
Well, I think I concur with Rashad with the notion that we all have a purpose in life. We all have a role to play in this earth. And for me, looking at how the skill sets I have and where my passions lie, I realized early on in life that for me it's to work in some capacity in government. throughout my adult life. After graduating from Morehouse College, I have worked in various capacities in order to effectuate positive change, either on the ground or as a part of government and regarding DeKalb County as director of two offices there for Keep DeKalb Beautiful and for Community International Affairs, or working with Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney in order to address issues of human rights in Cuba or in other parts of the world where we felt that people's political rights were being violated and undermined and compromised. And then here in Georgia, working for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund as a policy analyst in the southeast region of the United States, going from state to state, getting blasted by delegates or representatives of each state in regards to the voter ID and anti-immigrant legislation or quality of life issues, equity of resources, things of that nature. And now the opportunity presented itself for me to share my message, to share my voice, who I am as a human being and what I care about and how I want to move Georgia forward. I mean, I think it's excellent where this year is a phenomenal year, at least for me politically. There's just so much opportunity and optimism. People feel excited about politics again, about government again. I truly believe in government as an institution. I don't think we can judge the institution by the people who are in the leadership at this point. I think government in and of itself, it's an excellent place in order to ensure that people's rights are respected and protected, as well as they receive the resources necessary in order to improve their quality of life, and in order to ensure that they become productive citizens. And so I want to be a part of that process. For me, what's in my heart most is the issue of poverty. I drive around the city of Atlanta every day, and I see people living underneath highways. And I see people in the streets begging for food or clothing. I see abandoned homes, and that people are squatters in there. And, you know, the idea that we're talking about squatters in the 21st century seems odd, but it's true. And when I go door to door talking to people in the community, you hear them talking about individuals across the street who have broken into homes and are just living there because they have nowhere else to go. And it's an issue that we have to address in the state of Georgia. For too long, we keep looking at the resultants of poverty. We're not looking at poverty in and of itself. How do we address poverty? How do we mitigate its impact on the lives of so many people? When are we going to be serious about that so that way everybody can have a chance to succeed, which I think is what this country is about? Me, myself, my father had a sixth grade education. My mom had a high school education. But through the grace of God, they were able to work hard and ensure that my brother and I both graduated from college. And I, myself, I'm continuing my education and getting my master's in public administration. So, you know, the American dream exists, but for some people it looks like an American nightmare, and we have to pull the light, we have to pull the veil of ignorance and ensure that they have an opportunity to succeed just like other people have. So I'm in there for those people who have been voiceless for so long, who have been marginalized for so long, and people who really want a true voice, a true leader, a true champion for the cause that's important to them.
Yes, well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it to my co-host, Catherine. Why don't you take the next two questions?
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you guys for being on. I know it's Father's Day, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us this evening.
No problem.
I'll start with, I guess we're supposed to go alphabetically, so I'll start with you, Joel.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sure you're working in the community and, you know, pounding the pavement and talking to people.
Yes.
What are you hearing, and what are people concerned about, and how do you hope to help them?
Okay, excellent question. Thank you. Could I have your whole name, if that's possible?
Oh, Catherine Smith.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Thank you for that question. When I'm going throughout the district, what I'm realizing is there's a lot of commonalities. You hear the same issues arising, whether you're in Westview, West End, Washington Park, where I live at, or you're at English Avenue. What I hear about are really the three E's, what I call the three E's. It's the economy, education, and the environment. In regards to the economy, I think we all know what's going on. I mean, the taboo word today is recession, and there's some people who might not see a recession in their lives, but if you go into these communities and you see all these empty homes and you see people coming to me and I talk to them, they say, we need jobs. We have good people, hardworking people, people who want to be productive for themselves and their families, who want to be an integral part of improving their communities, but they need jobs, and not jobs that just pay $7 an hour. Jobs that will provide a living wage, jobs that will provide health care benefits, jobs that will allow for people to have the disposable income to get the goods and services they need in order to move their family forward from wherever condition they're in now to hopefully to middle class, to home ownership, because Lord knows we have plenty of homes in District 55 waiting for good home, good families to move into. So people are asking for jobs. People are concerned about health care. You know, I tell people about my own story. Here I am. I'm college educated. My wife is college educated. She's getting her PhD in African American history at Georgia State University. We have a son, 3-year-old son named Nation. We own 2 homes. We like to think that we're doing very well for ourselves, but we cannot afford health care for ourselves. We both own our own business, so we're incapable of affording health care. We pay for our son out of our own pocket, but we do not have health care for our own selves, because if we did, if we bought health care that we can afford, the deductible would be so high that I would have to be in a coma for 5 days in order to just reach the deductible. But if I want a low deductible, I have to pay like $1,000 a month in order to do so. And that's just, I just cannot afford that at this point. So healthcare is a big issue for people. Senior issues is so big for people. I mean, walking throughout the district, there's something in the water in District 55, because I'm running into women who are like 95, 96 years old. There's a woman named Miss Ann Cooper who lives on MLK. She's 106 years old. Now seniors they're talking about their prescription prices. I met one woman who pays $200 a month for medicine, which is astronomically high, and she lives in the Oakland City area, on Oakland Drive. I talked to seniors, said, I can't get from point A to point B. I need public transportation, and then when I get transportation, I need somebody to help me get my bags, my groceries from wherever I'm at to the house. The seniors are saying, I need access to services within close proximity so that way I can ensure that my health is in good order, and also so I can just have quality food and quality amenities nearby. So senior issues is a big issue. Education, of course, is a big issue. As I said, as I told my own personal story, education has been my gateway to success, the reason why I'm speaking to you here today, and for my wife as well. My wife is one of 8 children, and she's the first person to graduate from college in her family. So we understand the importance of education and how it's a part of the American dream. And there are young people here who are intelligent young people, but unfortunately there are issues at play that are preventing them from excelling academically. And we all know the stories, we all know the statistics, and that can't be accepted, it can't be tolerated. And lastly, the one big issue that people are really concerned about is the environment. Unfortunately, a lot of people look at certain parts of District 55 as dumping grounds, as their own place in order to just throw away used tires, refrigerators, air conditioners, couches and furniture, what have you. And that's unacceptable. You cannot treat another person's community like that. These are cowards that come in the middle of the night who want to dump in other people's community and then ride off and act like nothing happened. But something is happening. You're destroying the fabric of a community. You're using the community as your own landfill, and that's unacceptable. When I was director of Keep the Cab Beautiful, we fought vigorously in order to prevent that from happening in our communities. We put up signage. We had more law enforcement to look at that. We build relationships with community leaders around the areas in order to prevent that from happening. We need to do that here as well. So that's the first part of your question. The second part of your question is, what can I do? Well, the first thing we have to do is make sure that people understand that these issues are going on. What I've seen in the past, working in the state capitol as a lobbyist, is that a lot of good legislation gets introduced, but it's not really spoken about, and the legislators are not really pushing it forward into the forefront, building momentum. I guess this is the communication person in me, but my thinking is that if you have good legislation, you have to let it out. You have to let people know about it so you can build some sort of movement around it, so you can get the opportunity in order to get it passed. So the first thing we have to do is let people know what the issues are, and the only way I can do that is by going around the district, talking to people, trying to get an idea of what's important to them, because whatever's important to them is important to me. Then the second part we have to do is identify those people who have been working tirelessly on these issues. I'm not going to sit here, I'm not going to speak on this phone and say that I know everything, because I don't. But I do know there are people who are experts in various fields, in education, in the economy, in the environment, in mortgage fraud, what have you, who can help me fashion public policy that would address these issues. Because at the end of the day, it's critical that we look for solutions. I mean, the people in Georgia are tired of rhetoric. They're tired of hearing the same old, same old. They're tired of hearing about the bickering, the grandstanding, the hyperbole, the sensationalism, all that going on. Because what because what happens is they wake up the next day and the problem is still staring them in the face, and they're wondering who out there will speak for me. And I want to be that person to champion that. So I'm looking forward to working with my colleagues in the House. I look forward to working with experts in various fields, academia, the nonprofit sector, and community leaders on the ground in order to fashion a collective comprehensive plan to figure out how we can address these issues and move forward, get bipartisan support on it, and recognize that the problems that exist within Atlanta doesn't occur in a vacuum. I think that's an important issue that needs to be pointed out, that the issues that occur in Atlanta are Georgia issues. And so we have to make sure that other Georgia legislators realize that if there's a problem in Atlanta, don't think that it won't impact you one way or another. But the converse is true, too. When I go into the House in January, I intend to join the rural caucus because I want to let my brothers and sisters know who live in rural Georgia that I appreciate the issues that are affecting you, and I want to be a part of the solution process, and I want to work with you on those issues that are important to you, and I hope in turn you will reciprocate my efforts and you will work with me on issues that are important to me in where I represent, because at the end of the day, we're all Georgians, and at the end of the day, we have to work together in order to move Georgia forward. If we don't do that, it's to our detriment and to our chagrin.
Thank you very much, Joel.
Thank you.
Hey, Rashad, how are you doing?
Good, Catherine. How are you?
Nice to have you here tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, my question for you is very similar. You know, I'm sure that you're also working in the working in the district and talking with people, and just interested if you're hearing the same thing, what you plan to do, if you have, you know, I'm sure you have some different ideas about what people are concerned about, and if you give you the opportunity to express your stand on some of these issues and
yeah,
what people are talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people are, I think, talking about some of the same things that Joel just expressed, but I hear over and over again in all these neighborhoods I go to is the issue of foreclosures. I mean, the number of empty houses in our neighborhoods is staggering. Even here on my street where I live, you know, every other house is empty or boarded up, even every other house on either side of mine.
Yeah, you know, I drive through District 55 every day because it's on my way to work, and you're absolutely right. There's an unbelievable number of foreclosures around. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's devastating. It's having a devastating impact on our communities. And so one thing I, you know, want to do is a couple of things. You know, I worked for a while with Senator Ford on the President's Lending Bill back in 2002, and we had passed the nation's strongest bill against predatory lending. But when Sonny Perdue took over, the first thing he did was to reverse everything that Rory Barnes had done on that bill. And so we see the impacts that is having on our communities. One thing that I want to do is I would advocate for a moratorium, a six-month moratorium on foreclosures in Georgia to allow people on the verge of foreclosure to work with their mortgage companies to find a solution to their situation. One thing people have working against them in Georgia is time. I mean, you can foreclose on someone in 37 days, and that's certainly not enough time to work with your mortgage company. It's barely enough time to try to find a new place to live. And so if we can extend that time from 60 to maybe 90 days, have a six-month moratorium on foreclosures, a lot of those people who can work out a situation with their mortgage company to work it out, you won't be able to save everyone, but those who can be saved, we can keep them in their houses. I think that will be the first step to sort of stemming this problem that we're having. The second thing I'd like to do is have more foreclosure intervention programs. I mean, people, you know, 1 or 2, 3 months behind on their mortgage payments, they know that they are, you know, on the verge of foreclosure or on the path to foreclosure. Sometimes they don't contact their mortgage company because they're embarrassed. Some people don't know that they have options, that their mortgage companies may be willing to work with them. So more programs to allow people who are on the path to foreclosure to get away from it. Another thing I'm hearing just across this district, not just with foreclosures, but it's really saving Grady Hospital. I mean, all over this district, people are concerned that Grady may be forced to close its doors. People are somewhat calm now that the nonprofit board has taken over, that there's been an infusion of nonprofit dollars at Grady, that the state has just allocated some money to Grady, but they are very concerned that the state is not doing its part to shore up Grady and other trauma care hospitals throughout Georgia. The final thing that I'll talk about that I only heard after I experienced this myself was there's a big problem with copper thefts, not just in Atlanta or District 55, but throughout Georgia. I mean, about 4 weeks ago, I got hit. In my home, I have two air conditioning units, one for the upstairs, one for the downstairs, and both of them were broken. Both of them are going to cost them thousands of dollars to fix just for someone to steal $50 worth of copper. And once I got hit, I started to inquire with my neighbors and found out that there are several houses in this neighborhood throughout this district and this city that have been hit as well. A church in this district was hit. Eight units were broken, and the church has suffered about $30,000 worth of damage. And the person who stole the copper was someone that the church was feeding and giving clothing to. So it's become a big problem. And one thing I've been looking into is, 2 years ago, the legislature tried to act on this. This has been a growing problem the last few years. The legislature, Doug Stone and others, passed legislation to crack down on, or really to enhance the penalties on people stealing the copper. More jail time, more fines, so on and so forth. I think the problem is not on the people stealing the copper. I think we could solve the problem of the people who are buying the stolen copper. If we can crack down on the people buying the copper, I think that'll cut down a lot of these copper thefts. One thing I want to do is to ban the cash sale of copper. I mean, you can't bring in a handful of copper and expect to get $50 in cash. You have to be issued a check. You have to show valid identification. That information will have to be recorded. Some states require that a picture of you and the copper be taken so that if there are thefts in the area, the police can go to these copper dealers and get pictures of the people who have been selling the copper and pictures of the copper so they can see, try to trace it back to the place where it was stolen from. Those are a couple of things I think we would want to do. But all of this really is stemming from our failing economy. People's need to steal copper, so many homes in foreclosure, so many people being forced to use Grady Hospital because they don't have health insurance. All of this really comes from our economic situations here in Georgia and throughout the country. And so I think one thing we need to do is have more good-paying jobs in Georgia, more job training programs for people to get them back to work. And I would like to invest more money in vocational education. You know, they do a lot of college prep in our high schools now, but everyone is not college-bound. And so when you're sitting in class and the teacher's only talking about college preparation, you're not interested, and you don't think that there are options out there for you in your future. But there are plumbers, AC repairmen, and other people who make very good money, very good livings, and I think young people need to know that there are options out there other than college. So those are some of the things that I'm hearing and some of the things that I will plan to do when I get elected.
Thank you very much, Rashad. On to you, Tim.
Yes, and I'm going to reverse the order and start with Rashad Taylor. How are you doing tonight, Rashad?
Good. How are you, Tim?
I'm very good, and I'm going to ask each of you a question, a more specific question that pretty much applies to each of you personally. And the first question, Rashad, is this, and I'm sure you've heard this question a lot already, and it's simply this: why would the political director of the Democratic Party of Georgia seek a seat in the Georgia State Legislature?
It's a good question. You are correct. I have gotten this question a lot. One thing I will tell you is that it is not uncommon for staffers and state parties to also serve an elected office. I've worked at the Capitol as a lobbyist. In my role as political director, I was sort of the de facto caucus director for the House and Senate caucuses, trying to coordinate a legislative and electoral agenda between our two caucuses. I think we were semi-successful this year. And standing up as Democrats, we had not done that in years past. So I got to see firsthand at the high level, strategy meetings and at the general caucus meetings, what goes on at the state capitol. And I thought that I could just lend my knowledge of the Capitol, my desire to do what's right, and my willingness to serve as a Democratic member of the caucus. I thought that I could offer myself, you know, for public service, you know, as a state representative. The funny thing is, you know, the legislature is a part-time job, so most people have to have full-time jobs. Mine just so happens to be political director for the Democratic Party. You know, Calvin Smyre was chairman of the party, and he was also a state representative. You know, Michael Thurman is an elected official. He's also a vice chairman of the party. So it's not uncommon for elected officials to also serve, you know, in leadership roles at the party. And so I don't, you know, it's probably the first time in our history that an elected official will be a staff member at the party. But I won't be sworn in until January, and we have a lot of work to do between now and November. Where I won't be an elected official, I'll just sort of be a state representative-elect. You know, I don't, it's a little uncommon for Georgia, but we're in uncommon territory. So I think we need as much good talent as we can get at the state capitol, to be honest, and I thought that I would offer myself for service.
Okay, thank you, sir. Mr. Alvarado, I am looking at your excellent website, very well put together, and
yeah,
I wanted to ask you,
I appreciate that.
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask you something. What do you mean by the term dinner table platform?
Good question. How that came about is going door to door. You know, you recognize, and then also in my own personal life, when people sit down at the dinner table, they're talking about issues that are impacting their home. They're talking about, are you going to have your job next week? Are we going to be able to pay our mortgage? Did you hear about what happened down the block? That person's house was foreclosed. How is this $1 that we have going to cover A, B, and C? There's a conversation that goes on, and that conversation we have to tap into, because that's what real Georgians are talking about. They're trying to figure out that last year they had a dollar. That dollar was able to get A, B, and C, and these were needs, not wants. But today, with our economy, they can get A, maybe get B, but C, they're really trying to figure out how to get. And that's a problem, because we're talking about these are needs, not wants. And so it becomes vital that we, as elected officials, listen to the conversations people are having. I think a lot of times you have elected officials who want to pontificate, who want to act as if they are fully aware of the needs of the people, and it's based on their own perception, their own belief as to what they think is true. Me, I don't want to operate like that. This notion of representation is very important to me. And for me, representation means that I'm listening to what the people are talking about, and will work to formulate public policy to address those issues that they are having conversations about. People are not talking about some of these emotional issues that folks like to focus their attention on to get the people riled up, especially during when it's time to get out the vote, as we all know what happens. We're talking about everyday, good-natured, hard-working Georgians who get up in the morning, put their pants on, put their dress on, and go to work hard, come on home, and then they have to figure out, okay, we keep going back and forth, but we have to worry about child care, we have to worry about our children's education, we have to worry about the community in which we live in, we have to worry about paying our mortgage, we have to worry about paying for food, we have to worry about conserving gas because it's so expensive now, we have to worry about conserving water and what does that mean in long term. We have to worry about the environment for ourselves and for our children. These are the conversations people are having, and somebody needs to recognize that and be willing to work to do that. And if I may, sir, Rashada brought up the issue about foreclosures, and as well as coupled with that would be mortgage fraud, of course. If I may, in looking at that process, which I guess is part of the dinner table conversation as well, as you read, is there's two points regarding the foreclosure issue. We have to, and mortgage fraud, we have to deal with the issue of appraisal in Georgia, where the appraiser, it has so much power because they determine what a value of a home is, and that allows a person who has intentions of purchasing that property for the sole purpose of taking out the equity that has been determined based on the appraisal. We need to regulate. We need to figure out how to ensure that appraisers, and I'm not speaking in generality, I'm not saying all appraisers do so-and-so, but it's very obvious considering that Georgia has one of the highest rates of mortgage fraud, especially areas in a district like Westview. Westview is like one of the highest, has one of the highest rates of mortgage fraud in the United States. So obviously there are appraisers there who are not working in the best interests of the community and of the other practitioners. They're working on their own best interests. So we have to ensure that we have policies in place, regulation in place, enforcement powers in place to ensure that appraisers are doing what they're supposed to do in a fair and equitable manner. Secondly, what I hear as well is that too many property owners are just somehow their names are stuck in reams of paper. You know, you see a property that's abandoned or that's sitting there and the grass is not being cut and people are breaking into it and doing this and doing that. And let's say a citizen in that neighborhood or community leader tries to identify who's the property owner, and it's like trying to climb Mount Everest. And that's a problem. I think accountability in this issue is critical. And so we have to bring these property owners to light to let them know that if you're not going to be good stewards of this property, you might not live in this community, but you own property in this community, and it's your responsibility to ensure the upkeep of this property. And it's also your responsibility to ensure that you're working with community members in order to identify quality homeowners to move in and to build that community. And if you do not do that, then we need to look seriously at what penalties we can offer that are constitutional to compel this person in order to do the right thing. At the end of the day, going back to your initial question, it's about that family in Georgia. What can I do as their representative in the House of Representatives to improve their quality of life, to ease their burden somehow? If government is the only institution with the capacity to do so, then it's incumbent upon us. We have a social responsibility in order to be our brothers and sisters keepers. That's what I live by. That's what I practice. That is a major principle in my life, and that's what I plan to do as the next state representative of District 55.
Okay, thank you, sir. David, back to you.
Yes, well, I wanted to ask y'all one final question that's, I guess, a little more creative, not like the first to ask, which are the basics we ask of every guest, who are you and why you're running. Today, Barack Obama gave a Father's Day speech at a church in Chicago, and it was talking about absentee fatherhood, and that's something that affects all races more than it did in the past, but particularly minorities. And y'all both being men of color, I'm sure y'all have thoughts on this issue. If you've heard the speech, you can comment on the speech and your thoughts on the issue. If you haven't heard the speech or read it, then you can just comment on the issue in general. But Barack Obama has it on the front of his site, for instance, is linked. Joel, I guess we'll start with you.
David, could you repeat what is it that you wanted to know if we had read?
It's a speech on fatherhood, and particularly in the black community,
mm-hmm.
But really in all communities. The absentee fatherhoodism
okay.
that we have in these days that's increasing and what it's doing to society.
Okay.
Your thoughts are on it.
I understand. Thank you. I have not read that, but I will say that I enjoyed an excellent sermon today. I'm a new member of Reverend Gerald Durley's church, Providence Missionary Baptist Church on Cascade, and he had an excellent sermon today about fatherhood. He looked at Luke 15, and is this a secular show? Can I say Luke 15?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
we
might not know
government run,
about.
So we can talk about any
scripture. Okay, I don't want to. You know, I don't want to step on anybody's toes here, but nonetheless, Luke 15, you notice the parable. It's the parable about the father who has two sons. One son asks, "Hey, Dad, can I get my share of the estate?" And he goes off into the world and blows up all his money, and then he's like poor and destitute, and he ends up being raising pigs. And you have to remember, this is a person who's of Jewish faith, so he got so low that he's actually tending to pigs and eating the same food pigs are eating. Well, he comes back home, and he comes back basically humbled and speaks with contrition, but his father opens, welcomes back with open arms and so happy because he sees that he was lost in regards to his thinking, but now he's found. And the point I'm trying to make is that me as a father, one of the most important jobs in my life is being a father to my son. I love my son with all my heart and soul. I would do anything for that child because he's an extension of me. He needs for me to be the best man I can be in his life, and he needs for me to be an exemplary example. And every day I wake up, I want to make sure the last thing I ever want to do is embarrass him or make him be ashamed of for being my son, because that would devastate me more than anything in the world. And I think if men are willing to step forward and recognize the beauty and the joy of childhood and having children and how they're so precious and they're a gift from God, and that we need to do the best we can to nurture them, to protect them, to ensure that they have all the resources that are available to them so that way they can be the best they can, because their success is our collective success as a society, and we have a responsibility. Now, the thing is with the issue with men, with men of color, and especially African-American men and being fathers and fatherless children, you know, it is an issue, but I think that sometimes the media likes to overblow issues of and likes to look at the negatives when, you know, you have over 40 million African-Americans living in the United States. They want to focus on those few who are not responsible as they should be, when there are so many loving men who are fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers that are doing excellent work, but we still need to hold these individuals accountable. I think it's critical that I believe in the institution of marriage, and I believe in children, and I believe in doing the best you can for children. And what we have to do is it's just this attitude that's pervasive within certain parts of our community where they think that the norm is somehow not applicable to them, and it's so damaging. You know, you might have heard a story one time, I think it was on television, that a woman went into a classroom, and a young male, African-American male, was asking her about parenthood. And so she was so excited about, you know, this person really wanted to be as responsible. It's a young child, maybe in the middle school, late middle school years, and wanting to know how to be a good parent. So then she mentioned the word marriage. And she's like, no, I'm not talking about marriage. Marriage is for white people. And, you know, when I read that or when I heard that, that was devastating to me. How did that happen? I mean, we come from a people that at one time were willing to risk their lives in order to be married. And now all of a sudden marriage has been relegated to something that only white people do, or that if you're African American, you get married, you're acting white. We have to figure out how did that happen. Because that is so devastating. I mean, we've seen time and time again just beautiful families together. I mean, for me, I was listening a little bit, Dave, when I got on. You were talking about Senator Obama and McCain. But, you know, you look at Senator Obama and his family, and I think that that's an excellent model for people to look at and say, look at the beauty, look at that family unit, look at how they are working together as one in order to do what they can for their children, for themselves, and for the community. That's the model that we need to put forward to people and let them know that you can do that too. Don't think that that is not a part of you. It is. Because at the end of the day, you know, when men are unwilling to take responsibility, and if you are with a person and you're not willing to take care of your children or to be with that person in the long-term committed relationship, that's problematic. Do you know that the city of Atlanta ranks number one in child poverty? You know, and did you know that about almost 70% of single mother households live at or below the poverty level, many of them in District 55? That's the resultant of men not being responsible. We have children who are living in poverty, and which leads to many of the problems that Rashad alluded to with regards to breaking into homes or stealing copper, or, you know, acting in a manner that's just unproductive for them, both short-term and long-term. And we can't have that. We, like I said before, we have a moral responsibility. We have a social responsibility, but we also have a personal responsibility. And I'm hoping that any man, regardless of who you are listening, please, if you are in a committed relationship, treat the woman that you're with the respect they deserve, one. Two, if you have a child, be the best parent you can be. Whether you're living with the child or not, it is your responsibility. You brought this child into the world. Do not look at this child as a burden, but as a possibility of you planting a seed to a better tomorrow within this child. Because the work you put into this child will bear fruit. It will, your investment in this child now will ensure that in the future, in the long run, this child can be the person who maybe finds the cure of a sickness that is hurting so many people. This child might end up being the scientist to discover a new way of creating alternative fuels. This person might end up becoming president of the United States. We can't shortchange our kids. We have to give them the best we have to offer to ensure that we have a better tomorrow. So again, I implore anybody listening to me today, please, if you are a father, if you are a mother, love and protect your children. They are our greatest asset. They are our greatest resource. If we don't do it, then nobody else can do it better than the parents.
Yes. Rashad, same question about absentee fatherhoodism. If you want to comment on the speech, if you're familiar with it today, or other things you know about it, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I haven't read or heard the speech, but I will definitely look it up. But I know firsthand about, you know, absentee fathers, because my father was not around. When my mother and father divorced when I was 2 years old, it was another 19 years before I either saw or spoke to my father. So I grew up with just my mother and with great uncles and other family members to help, you know, raise me and give me that sort of male influence in my life. So on Father's Day, I send my mom a Father's Day card saying thank you for being, you know, my mother and my father for all those years. There's a devastating impact of, you know, absentee fathers, particularly in the African-American community. I think it's more than 55% of black kids grow up in single-parent households. And, you know, I mean, and the statistics tell us that those kids more times than not end up dropping out of school or, you know, going to prison, committing crimes, and all that. So there's an impact on our community when fathers are not around to do their jobs. One thing I know is that a lot of times fathers are absent because they are young and immature. Young people getting pregnant, and the father ends up being not around, 16 years old, they are not ready to take responsibility for a child. So one thing I think we can do as a society to try to stop this absentee father situation is to try to stop unintended pregnancies, comprehensive sex education for young people, make sure young people have access to contraception, make sure they have access to emergency contraception, so that, because we know that these unintended pregnancies end up with the father not, you know, being around, or sometimes they end up terminating the pregnancy. So I think that's one thing that we can do. Another thing I would hope is that, you know, people just grow up with some type of, even if the father is not around, that they grow up with some type of positive male influence in their life. Lesbian couples who adopt, there may not be a father around for that child, but, you know, hopefully there is a father figure in their life. So I don't want to just limit it to the mother and father aspect of a family, but just making sure that there are positive male role models in young people's lives, male and female. Young men and young women need to have a positive male influence in their life, and I think that they will grow up being more responsible members of our society. You know, when people grow up without a father in their life, you know, they think that that is the norm or that is how it's supposed to be. And so they then become absentee parents. And it just continues a cycle that we don't need to continue. And so part of what I've done in my own just community service is try to be a mentor to young men. If they have father figures in their lives or if they don't, so they know that there are young black men out there who are doing positive things and that they too can do positive things. I did want to mention just something quickly on the foreclosure issue, because, you know, one of the things that the legislature did that was somewhat positive was that they, because it's oftentimes, Joel was right, it's hard to track down the people who own the property for a lot of these vacant homes. The city doesn't have the resources to go after them. The state has failed to find out who owns the home. So one thing that the state did, which I like, was that this past session, I think it was SB 531, or so, but they said that before you file foreclosure proceedings on your property, that you have to file with the clerk's office the names and contact information of the person who owns the property so that we will know who to go after when this property becomes unsightly or if it becomes unsafe. I think that will go into effect July 1 of this year. So that hopefully will help us in going after the people who own these properties who are not, you know, taking care of their properties.
Yes, well, I want to thank y'all for both coming on. I am going to give y'all just one little tiny bit of closing. The hour is almost up. But I want to tell you, back in 2002, I lived in a multi-member district in which two reps represented one district. I think the legislature needs to consider making the 55th a multi-member district because I think we have two fine gentlemen to fill those seats.
Hey,
but go ahead.
Absolutely.
Go ahead and each of y'all, kind of as you, I mean, close, and really we don't even have time for a closing statement, but go ahead and take the time if somebody wants to help with your campaign between now and July 15th. Tell them how. And go ahead first, Joel.
Okay. Again, I want to thank the panel for your questions. I want to thank you for the opportunity allowing us to speak. I think it's important that the electorate has the information they need to make sound decisions regarding who they want to represent them July 15th. For me, you can give me a call at 404-513-6699. That is my cell number. It is on my hip more times than I like it to speak, but please give me a call. Also, you can look at my website at www.alvaradoforstatehouse. That is A-L-V as in victory, A-R-A-D-O forstatehouse.com. You will see my bio. You have contact information there for me to get a hold of you. You have some op-eds that I've written that have been printed, and you also have my platform. I look forward to working with anybody who cares about Georgia and cares about District 55 and is committed to positive change in our communities. Thank you.
Rashawn?
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me, and thanks just for the work that you do with the Kudzu Vine. I know it's a very well-listened-to show. A lot of people listen to it to get the insight in Georgia politics, and I think you're doing a great thing. I always tell people there's two good folks in this race, and it's going to be a tough decision on July 15th. But I would love to have everyone's support. They can visit my website, rashadtaylor.com, rashadtaylor.com. They can send me an email from the website. They can always call me at 404-503-8006, 404-503-8006, if they want to get more involved.
Yes, well, thank y'all both for coming on again, and I hope people listen to this throughout the week and tell anybody in your district that needs to make up their mind to log on the show and listen to y'all.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Catherine. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Have a blessed day.
Bye. Well, bye. Tim, we're probably going to run over, but I think we must do it for our podcasters. Go ahead and start in with the GOP Outrage of the Week.
Okay, David, there was a little bit of news that came out this week, and it probably flew under the radar. Not too many political people even noticed it that much, and the average citizen most likely didn't hear of it at all. It all began last year with the governor's fiscal year 2008 revenue estimate. This estimate helps to develop the entire state budget. According to the governor's budget proposal, fiscal year 2008 revenue growth was estimated to be at 2.7%. Well then, I suppose a new report that just came out hit the governor's office like a ton of bricks. It was released to media outlets by the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. And guess what? No revenue growth was forthcoming. Not only that, but there was actually a revenue decline for the first 11 months of this fiscal year. If revenues are sluggish for June, then we are looking at the possibility of as much as a $600 million budget shortfall for this year. So the governor will be forced to tap into something called the RSR. That is the Revenue Shortfall Reserve, which contains funds for just this eventuality. Problem is, if the economy doesn't rebound and the same thing happens in 2009, then this fund will be totally exhausted. Now, that news is not outrageous as such. After all, the economy is in the tank all over the country. Lots of states are facing these shortfalls. But there are a couple of things in all of this that I do find to be a bit outrageous. First of all, just consider, if you will, how little our state legislature actually did this past year. Instead of addressing real issues like education, health care, transportation, etc., what did they do? Well, they argued about tax cuts, and thank God they never agreed on any. Because, folks, if these state cuts had tax cuts had actually gone through, then this state might well be looking at going into default. And secondly, our governor's office did its usual and blamed it all on the legislature. Not only that, they also took time to brag on the governor and how his wise stewardship of the state budget had resulted in proper funds to cover the shortfall. Now, for me, I have a somewhat different view because the governor submits a budget proposal and the legislature then tinkers with it and passes it, and then the governor signs it. So that tells me that there's enough blame for all of them. And once again, the people of Georgia have been bitten. These Republicans are who they elected. These same Republicans promise great things for Georgia, and it is these same Republicans who have failed to deliver. And when I say Republicans, I mean all Republicans, and that includes our party-switching governor, whose budget revenue estimates put us in a fiscal hole. And what of the future? Well, it looks bleak. We are paying for the failed policies of Republicans, not only here in Georgia, but all over the country. That's why it's time for a change. They've been running Georgia. They have failed, David.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Tim. And so much we didn't get to. The Senate race had new television spots, new polls, new comments, if you will. We didn't get to any of that. You know, congressional races going on. We just, a lot of stuff we didn't get to cover, but we'll be back next week, and hopefully we can definitely get into some of that U.S. Senate talk. Also, we'll talk a little bit about VP selection. Now that the presidential candidates are both set, it may be time to look at that as well. And don't want to say too much, but it looks like we may cover a little Texas politics, you know, journeying around the South. So we'll see y'all then. Have a good time, Tim.
Thank you.
Catherine.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye.